community at gmail.com, or by mailing or dropping off the completed documents to the station to the attention of Timothy Welp, KBOO Community Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please send in your application by 5 p.m., February 15, 2016. If you have any questions, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com. Thank you for your support of Community Radio.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KBOO live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KBOO. Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. Radio.
And it's 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up is the food show. Chris Siegel is the host today, and he is standing by in the studio. Want to also thank you very much for listening to KBOO, and thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you aren't a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing.
Welcome to the Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. In this show, Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising, a group of individuals dedicated to teaching permaculture ideas, will be joining me in the studio. I'll be talking with Marisha about growing your own vegetables for the entire year, as well as some of the classes she'll be offering this coming winter and spring. I'll also have some food news that we are following here at the Food Show. But first, are you a picky eater, or are you willing to try anything? Are there foods and flavors you love while others you find absolutely repulsive? The reality is that a lot of your food habits likely formed before you could communicate with another human being. In her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, Bea Wilson addresses how we interact with food at the beginning of our lives and the impact those early interactions have. The book is helpful not only in guiding new parents toward growing healthy children, but it also gives adults a greater understanding of their eating habits and how they can change and improve. Bea Wilson is currently on tour promoting her book. She stopped by KBOO while she was in Portland to talk with me about First Bite. Here's that interview. Why did you decide to write First Bite?
There's a couple of reasons. For a long time, for years, I had at the back of my mind that I was going to write a book about children's food. And when I started on this project, that's absolutely what I thought it was. I have three kids, and they all eat completely differently, and one of them's much pickier than the other two. My oldest one is the opposite of picky. He'll kind of seek out the weirdest, craziest flavours and get bored really quickly with food. And I was interested in looking into where do children's tastes come from? Why are they so different? And the more I looked at kids and the way they eat, the more struck I was that so many of the joys and pitfalls of childhood eating are still there for us as adults. You know, we still avoid what disgusts us. We still clean what's on our plate, maybe, even though our parents aren't there standing over us, watching us. We still reward ourselves with treats. Maybe we're not chucking food under the table when no one is looking. There are a few things that change. But I was struck that many adults are stuck in the tastes of children. And then a second strand came in, which I wasn't planning to write about at all when I started. But I kept thinking about my own experiences with food and how as a teenager and a young adult for years, I was really unhappy about food. I would have probably described myself as a compulsive eater. I seemed to have no stop button on my eating. And then I'd go on these short-lived diets and they wouldn't work. And it was partly a response to living with my sister who was anorexic. And it was partly lots of other things. It got worse after my parents divorced. And then somehow, over a period of months, if not years, without actively going on a diet, something changed. And my cravings for vegetables increased and my cravings for pastries lessened, although there have been a few pastries I've had since I've been on this trip to Seattle and Portland where I'm thinking, no, maybe I'll just rethink my position on pastries and vegetables. But overall, I feel happy about food. And it's just wonderful to have reached this point of change. And the book is really looking at why is it that some of us have this tortured, miserable, difficult relationship with food in so many different ways? And why is it that some of us actually find the whole process of eating quite easy, as I do now? I eat without guilt. I'm very happy and grateful to say.
Yeah, it does feel like one part guidebook for, you know, an expecting parent, and then another part like this sort of resource to get perspective on your own individual eating and experience.
I really hope so. I wanted it to be equally useful both for parents and for people who are looking at their own eating habits. And after all, we've all been children once, so that I'm hoping also the parenting aspect would interest people even who don't have kids, because you can just think back and think, huh, when I was a baby, I was being exposed to these flavours, and maybe that's why I still gravitate towards these flavours.
And so you talk about the impact of learning to eat. It begins very early on. And so you describe an age range where we're most impacted by new foods and flavors. When do we learn the most about eating habits and food?
Well, probably in the first 2 years of life. So part of the reason that most of us don't think of our eating habits as learnt is that so much of the learning happens very early on when we're not conscious of it. So by the time we're aware that we've got preferences, we just think they're this innate part of ourselves. But the science, and this has been backed up by numerous studies, shows that you actually, most of these tastes for specific foods, they're a function of exposure, they're a function of memory. But a lot of the memories, they might even be happening in utero, depending on what a mother's diet consists of. We know that amniotic fluid can taste incredibly garlicky if a mother eats lots of garlic. There was another study done where the mothers drank a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy. Their babies had this really positive experience eating carrot-flavoured cereal, and they preferred it over plain cereal. And that's months later. That shows that we can be sort of imprinted with these early flavour memories. But there's another period, the period between 4 months and 7 months in a baby's life. Psychologists refer to this as a flavour window, and it seems that this is a period when human beings are possibly more open-minded about new flavours than they ever will be again. And so the advice that we're given from the World Health Organization that you should do exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months, well, great for the mothers who are doing exclusive breastfeeding, but we know that because of patterns of work, and in the UK, it's something like only 1% of mothers are still doing exclusive breastfeeding. In the US, it's slightly more, but I think it's definitely far in the minority, maybe 10%. So actually what's happening is that those babies are being exposed to formula milk rather than breast milk. It would be much better if they could, at that age, be being given a taste of a range of different vegetables, not for the sake of they need the vegetables for nutrition, but just to give them a sense of this whole world of flavour.
So you talk about this idea that it doesn't take a single taste, that it takes sort of repeated exposure Can you tell us about the idea of tiny tastes and how repeated encounters with novel foods build taste tolerance?
Yeah. So lots of parents are familiar with this idea that you're only going to get a kid to like a food if they try it multiple times. Sometimes people say 15 times, sometimes 10. Actually, there is no exact number. And it seems that once you've persuaded a child to like a few different foods, you get in a virtuous circle kind of situation and it probably won't take as many attempts. But in response to that, loads of parents would say, well, how do I expose my child to broccoli when they don't want to eat it even once? Maybe they're gagging and spitting and crying at the thought of putting it in their mouth. So this new concept, tiny tastes, is really revolutionary. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds really too simple, almost. And I thought this when I first came across it. But it's had amazing results, both working clinics with kids who are on the really extreme end of the selective eating spectrum, a lot of whom are autistic, some of whom are down to eating just two or three foods like hot dogs, grilled cheese sandwiches, and are having to be fed by tube. The concept is if the food being tasted is as small as a grain of rice, suddenly the pressure on the child is massively reduced and they can put it in their mouth because it doesn't have the sort of same texture. I mean, if we imagine what it would be like if someone said, will you put this slug in your mouth? You probably don't want to. But just maybe if it was, you know, really tiny, smaller than a spoonful, smaller than a forkful, so small you could barely register it was there, you just might put it in your mouth. And what these studies have shown is that if you can get a child to have a tiny taste, whatever the food might be, 10 successive days, 14 successive days, the dislike will probably change to like. And I did it with my own youngest child and I was amazed. It converted him to eggplant, to cabbage, to all of these things I thought he'd never like. And it's not that he's by any means a perfect eater. I don't think any of us is. And he can still be reduced to tears at dinner time. But he'll sometimes now say to me things like, well, I like omelette. I really don't like soft-boiled eggs, but one day I might do tiny tastes with soft-boiled eggs and then I would like them. And to me, that's great that he's already somehow taken control of his own tastes.
He's bought into that system.
Yeah, he has. But it's somehow that shows to me it's not something I've imposed on him. It's completely the opposite of a parent saying, I want you to eat this, you should eat this. It's about changing your own desires.
Well, and it sounds very mature and sounds like something that a strategy that somebody who is a picky eater as an adult could potentially adopt.
Absolutely. And the director of a feeding clinic who I interviewed, who is the person who works with the kids that actually have full-blown feeding disorders, he's worked with numerous adults. He worked with a woman who wanted to be a missionary in the Philippines. She was very religious, but she was extremely picky to the point she would only have ketchup sandwiches and I forget a couple of other foods. She knew she didn't even eat rice. No way was she going to survive in the Philippines on, you know, their wonderful kind of pungent vinegars and garlic and all those flavors. And he did a version of Tiny Tastes with her and she managed to build it up to the point where she thought, yeah, I can go to Asia. I can eat anything.
So part of what you're describing is to sort of take the pressure off the eating experience. And so what I want to know more about is this sort of creating this stress-free environment. I mean, a lot of us have encountered the like clean plate idea, the sort of table battle where you have to finish everything mm-hmm. that's in front of you. You can't leave unless you do. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you have any advice for the feeder, for the people who are making the food decisions, how to create a stress-free eating environment.
It's easier said than done, as with all these things, because as a parent, I'm like this myself. It's the end of a difficult day. You've rushed home. You've desperately somehow cobbled together the ingredients to make something vaguely nourishing. And then to have it rejected is one of the most fury-making feelings. And you're thinking, the waste, can't they just eat it? Can't it just be simple? And it's very hard not to let your emotions get the better of you in that situation. But yeah, if somehow you can see that the end game is to get to the point where everyone at the table is actually enjoying food, and if everyone can just relax a bit, what we know about these exposures they definitely don't work if there's any sense of unpleasantness or pressure, or immediately the experience then becomes aversive. So it doesn't matter how many times you're putting broccoli in your mouth, if you feel that you're being forced or coerced, that will just have the opposite effect. It will put you off broccoli for life. So as far as you can as a parent, yeah, stop beating yourself up. Get rid of guilt. Stop talking about good and bad foods and just think, you know, food should be a joy. The aim is to get to the point where it's a pleasure, both for you and for the child.
It sounds like a lot like what sort of contemporary education is trying to accomplish, where you create an environment where the child wants to learn, not an environment where you're feeding the child information.
Yes, I think there are lots of analogies. Well, it is a form of education. I mean, that was one of these revelations I had while I was writing it, which I genuinely hadn't thought of before, because I hadn't actually, when I was starting the book, thought of even my central concept that we do learn how to eat. I wasn't quite sure that that was the case. And once I saw that it was, it changes everything, because you think, oh, we're going about this in the wrong way. And to me, it's kind of a way through, you know, it explains things like the obesity crisis. We are constantly wringing our hands about the food supply and saying, why are 2/3 of the population obese or overweight? And endlessly coming out with more advice on 5 a day. And we're not saying that's not how people learn to eat. As you say, it's about this kind of state of autonomy, when if you can get to a point where these forms of behavior are actually habits and preferences and you want to be eating in a healthy way, it's not to do with being virtuous. It's not willpower. That's just a stick which people use with which to beat the overweight and the obese. It's really quite horrible sometimes, the language that we use when we're talking about weight. And it really doesn't work. I mean, I know from myself, back when I was in my compulsive eating days, the more shame you feel, the more likely you are to eat in secret, and then you're going to eat so much more.
So I can think back to growing up and remember vividly food memories. And I want to ask about the power of food memories.
Food memories are incredibly powerful. I mean, I would go so far as to say that memory shapes all of our food yearnings. I have a few stories in the book about prisoners of war and how acute their desire for certain foods became that reminded them of home. And these American prisoners of war in Japan who were constructing these elaborate feasts for Thanksgiving dinners that they would never actually eat, consisting of kind of multiple courses of turkey and ham and every kind of stuffing and cranberry sauce and 10 different kinds of pie. And there's something really poignant about this, thinking that the memory just has this force, and it was something that they could share. And I think to some extent, we're all like that. One of the biggest problems with the way that we eat now is that so many of our feelings about foods that aren't going to do us good, you know, industrialized, cynically marketed foods, heavy in salt, sugar and fat, those are bound up in our mind with all of these memories that are good and true and pure, to do with family and home and security. So it's really hard for people to give these foods up or cut down on them without a sense of loss.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. That was the first half of an interview with Bea Wilson, author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. We'll continue with that interview in a moment, but here are some of the news we are following at The Food Show. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and Health and Human Services released the newest dietary guidelines at the beginning of January. In general, they are similar to previous guidelines with a few changes. One improvement is that they focus more on lifestyle and eating patterns as opposed to specific nutrients and food groups. They take into account the benefits of a diverse diet. The new guidelines also suggest that Americans limit their sugar intake to less than 10% of their daily consumption. That means that the average American needs to cut their sugar intake nearly in half. The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee also recommended that USDA and HHS include sustainability as a factor when making healthy food choices. Unfortunately, that addition to the guidelines was too contentious, and USDA and HHS left it out when the dietary guidelines were released. Also, instead of calling out specific foods that contribute to an unhealthy diet, such as high-in-sugar sodas and beverages and junk foods, the guidelines lump these foods into larger categories. The lack of specificity is in large part due to industry pressure. The pending Dow-DuPont merger could have huge effects on the American agriculture and food systems. Currently, Dow and DuPont are part of the Big Six of seed companies, also including Monsanto, BASF, Bayer, and Syngenta. The merger would mean that already small list would be reduced to 5 companies, consolidating the power of the seed and chemical industry. Not only would the merger eliminate jobs via corporate streamlining, but research and development following the merger would take a big step back, meaning farmers of primarily corn and soybeans would have even fewer options for purchasing seeds. In an age when climate change is creating a range of regional challenges for farmers, access to fewer varieties of seeds will make growing food that much more difficult. The goal of the merger is to produce short-term profits for the shareholders of the two companies by streamlining and selling off shared assets. Those short-term profits will have long-term effects on the food system. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is creating a pilot project to blind test for GMOs in organic products. The testing project was created at the request of organic growers in California. CDFA will be testing samples on a number of raw agricultural products with known risks for GMOs, including alfalfa, canola, corn, soy, zucchini, summer squash, cattle feed, and seeds. The goal is to expand the list at the end of the pilot project. Since this is a blind test, the results collected from testing will be aggregated without identifying individual farms and farmers. This is a small step in monitoring GMOs and shows that growers as well as many consumers believe this is an important issue facing sustainable agriculture and our food system. GMOs are currently prohibited from organic products by federal organic standards. These are some of the food news stories we're following. You can find details on these stories on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. Now, back to the interview with Bea Wilson, author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. You talk about the idea that all the food we eat is essentially children's food, since what and how we eat when we're young has such an impact on what and how we eat when we're older. So how should we approach the idea of children's food?
Yeah, so this was another thing which I hadn't thought of before, that if actually eating is something we learn, then children's food is the food that we learn with. So it's really not a great idea to be feeding them this strange version of cuisine which has been invented over the past couple of decades of kids' food, which seems to be the least nutritious food of all, highly sugary cereals, very few vegetables, loads of French fries. And there has been a bit of a backlash against it, and Michelle Obama's done some great work. Really, the concept of children's food, yes, in the early months of the first 2 years, children may need a modified diet. Obviously, they don't have the same capabilities of chewing that adults do at first, and they mustn't have anything with salt for the first year, and there's various things like that. But as soon as possible, to just see that children aren't these separate species like pets. They just need food. They need good, regular food like the rest of us. And sure, they're not going to have the same wide range of tastes that most adults do at first, because they haven't been exposed to such a wide range of flavors. But the fact that they reject broccoli or kale or carrots on the first bite doesn't mean they're not going to like it. It just means they haven't tried it enough times.
In the book, you talk about the idea of hunger, which in my mind has always been pretty simple. If you're hungry, that's you're experiencing hunger. But you describe that it's not as it's much more complicated than you would are led to believe. And so how do you determine hunger?
It's really hard. And a lot of it is cognitive. It's going on in the brain. We think we should just be able to recognize hunger. As you say, I thought this as well. I thought hunger is just one of those things. It's got to be instinctive, almost just like breathing. And far from it. I mean, hunger management, almost more even than becoming omnivorous about food, is one of the biggest problems that people have with eating. I know it was my problem. And it's a really difficult skill to learn, partly because we know that we're taking our cues about when to stop eating from so many external forces around us. If we've been taught by our parents, as many of us still are, leave a clean plate, and the plate is so much bigger, well, you could just be doing exactly what seems like the rational thing to do, and yet you're eating a portion which is vast and way more than you need. It also seems that there are these strange emotional elements to hunger. above and beyond. You know, scientists have tried to look into various biomarkers. There are various hormones you can identify which seem connected with hunger, but none of them gives you an absolute measure. And then there are these weird things where scientists got people to drink a glass of apple juice and say, are you hungry or full? And didn't fill them up. But when they heated the apple juice up and called it apple soup, the subjects were actually full an hour later. Which shows, you know, a lot of hunger is actually to do with what do we think we're going to be satisfied by. And the problem with diet foods is often that people don't believe they will be satisfied by quinoa or a salad or whatever it might be, because they've put this food in a category marked diet and austerity, and it's like the opposite of pleasure. And actually training yourself to think these foods can be satisfying too is a big thing.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that stood out to me was a study with a man who had short-term memory loss, yeah. And they managed to get him to eat three meals, convincing him that it was time to eat before he said he felt. I don't think he said that it was. He said he felt off.
Yes,
and that he couldn't
eat
because of that
reason.
Something
was wrong, but he still wasn't saying that he was full. Mm-hmm. I mean, which, and I think actually a lot of us are kind of like that. We don't have short-term memory loss, but we're constantly being pushed food from outside, which is kind of, and we should be saying, no, it's not lunchtime yet, or I don't need that. And it's very, very hard to say no when you're just sort of trying to go out to buy a newspaper and suddenly there are all these candy bars and it's as if they're speaking to you in some way. Hunger is really, really complicated. And also hunger in the developing world, I hadn't realised the extent to which that has a cultural element. Because this line that people often come out with about, well, we're so lucky in the States or Britain, the affluent West, we wouldn't have all these rarefied problems with food if we were properly hungry. You know, we wouldn't be anxious, there wouldn't be fussy eating, there wouldn't be anorexia. These are all problems of lucky societies. I don't think that's a very effective argument, because people are made deeply unhappy by these states, so therefore it is worth attempting to ameliorate them. Secondly, even if you look in the developing world, in communities where they're living with extreme hunger, hunger is still nuanced and complex. So there's this amazing food called Plumpy Nut, made of peanuts, which has changed the treatment of child hunger. And in Africa, it's been a huge success, saved thousands of lives. It's like a kind of supercharged peanut butter mixed with vitamins and various other things. And the child just squeezes it direct in their mouth. And there's no risk of the kind of hygiene issues there used to be with some of the other foods that used to get given out where mothers had to prepare them in the home. But in Bangladesh, when aid workers go in and offer the same food, the parents will often say, that doesn't look like food to me. I don't think it will satisfy my child's hunger. I think it's making them ill. And what this shows is, wherever you are in the world, whatever your state, hunger can't just be satisfied by any old thing. It's a very concrete thing. You know, we need to know what it was we were hungry for. And sometimes the thing we were hungry for wasn't food at all. It was love. It was security.
Well, you talk about, or you cite in the book, that up until the age of 3, a child can self-regulate hunger, meaning they stop eating when they become full. How could we maintain this ability beyond the age of 3?
It's very difficult to maintain it. This was a really interesting thing. I definitely didn't know this before doing the research. And it seems to cut across cultures. There have been studies done in China, some done in the States, that the ones in the States, you give a 3-year-old or 2-year-old child a portion of macaroni cheese. And if it's too big, they'll just eat less. If it's the right size, they'll eat the right amount. If it's too small, well, they'll eat all of it and that's all there is. But they just seem to have this magical ability to know how much their body needs. And if you give the same different portions to 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, suddenly they're eating more in response to the bigger portion. Or some people, which is kind of interesting, get put off by the big portion and eat less. Those are people who are probably on the picky eating spectrum. How do you maintain it? Well, I think as with lots of these things, you have to recognise it is a skill and you can relearn it. There was a study done by a paediatrician called Susan Johnson, and she went into a preschool for 6 weeks and taught the kids how to recognise their own hunger using dolls. And these dolls had kind of fake stomachs filled with varying amounts of salt. And so the children could put their hand on the doll's stomach and say, that one is full, that one's half full, that one's empty. And then they'd put their hands on their own stomach at snack time and compare it. And by the end of the 6 weeks, they were starting to say things like, I'm quite full, so I'm not going to eat anymore. And that's a great skill to be able to learn. And lots of us as adults still haven't mastered that one.
So you have a chapter on siblings, and it got me thinking about growing up with a sister. And there's this embarrassing video, an old family video where I'm shouting at my sister. We're at her birthday, and I'm like, you put more sprinkles on it. They're free. like trying to tell her and just over and over shouting this.
Is she older or younger?
She's younger. Mm. Yeah. And so I think she just ignored me, which she should have. Mm. But I just wonder how siblings shape the process of learning to eat.
They hugely shape it. And it's one of these many things where what my book is trying to do is say, we all recognize that there are problems with the way we eat, but we're not actually looking often at the psychological factors that go into why we're eating like that. And yeah, siblings make a huge impact on what you eat, how you eat, how much you eat. And I mean, everyone has these different stories, if they've got a sibling, to tell of sibling rivalry through food. And I've spoken to people who really looked up to an older sibling and copied them. I spoke to one woman, I didn't put this anecdote in the book in the end, who loved her older sister so much, and her older sister had a really strange, picky relationship with food. So she tried to copy her and also not eat food, even though she could tell that actually she was enjoying it. And it was only when she grew up and left home that she thought, huh, those are not actually my tastes. I was just borrowing them. And in my case, as I've already said, I think I was definitely reacting against my sister. She had a rabbit, I had a guinea pig. She starved, I binged. There was more to it than that. But it's amazing the extent to which you need to define yourself in a family through food and whatever way you find to do that. And my own kids, yeah, there's endless arguments about who's finished this or that thing of when you have a pizza or a cake and it's you cut and I will choose. But it's almost like one of those prisoner's dilemmas. You don't trust the other person to give you the fair slice.
And I imagine that you have these relationships with food and with family, and that they have great impacts on them when you get older and how you see food.
Yeah, as with so much of what's learnt in childhood, these things stay with us. So you may no longer be sitting next to your sibling with your spoons laid on the table side by side, but your responses to food are still being formed by that person. And one of the ways that this plays out is through gender. And this is obviously not in every family, thankfully, but it's amazing the extent to which even in this day and age, we are feeding boys and girls differently. And we're often feeding them in exactly the way that goes against their nutritional requirements. So with boys, there's strong evidence that across the world, parents have this view that boys don't need as much healthy food and that they need manly food, red meat. And we don't therefore push them to eat vegetables as much. And this is a real problem, you know. Most people are not eating enough vegetables, so it affects girls as well, but boys are especially not eating enough. So it doesn't really serve them very well to say, you're so manly, you don't need salad. And then with girls, conversely, the biggest nutritional need that they have growing up is for iron. Suddenly their iron needs jump from 8 milligrams to 15 milligrams during puberty. So to be saying to girls that they don't need this kind of hearty man food is absolute nonsense. And the idea that they could somehow subsist on lettuce leaves and chocolate and compliments, it's not very helpful. And there are also signs that, again, not all families, but in some families, enough that it can be measured statistically. There was a big, large-scale study of several thousand families in Minnesota who were studied over several years, proper longitudinal study, that showed that as girls got older, parents would put more pressure on them to lose weight, which is extremely counterproductive. When you pressurize someone to lose weight, it usually backfires and they actually gain weight. It also creates a horrible atmosphere at the dinner table. It doesn't make these girls feel good about themselves. Whereas with boys, the parents were backing off.
I want to finish with looking ahead. What does an ideal future look like where children grow up to be well-adjusted eaters?
Well, the first thing to say is it's entirely possible that it can happen. I felt really optimistic at the end of writing this book because if food habits are learnt, the great thing is that they can be relearned, sometimes in quite a short period of time. What would it look like? One of the positive models I came across was Finland, where about 10 years ago, they noticed they had really bad rates of child obesity compared to their neighbours in the rest of Scandinavia. And they decided to do something about it. And they transformed their preschool education system to make learning about food, not healthy lectures, but sensory learning about food through play. You know, they'll have sessions with sweet, sour, salty, bitter, or where they taste different kinds of berries, or where they go exploring, or where they cook together. In a very non-judgmental, just open-minded, just enhancing their palate kind of way. And this seems to have already had beneficial results. The kids will come home and say to their parents, can you please buy this strange new vegetable? I tasted it at nursery. It was great. That to me would be a pretty hopeful kind of model. But the other thing to say is, you know, we focus so much on children sometimes, we forget how awful it can be to be an adult who, you know, is trapped in whatever form of disordered eating, whether it's bulimia, whether it's anorexia, whether it's adult picky eating. And that can feel incredibly lonely and quite hopeless. And the other thing that writing the book taught me is we don't need to be fatalistic. Yes, it's really hard to change your eating habits. No one should underestimate that. It's not going to happen with some short-lived January diet. That won't cut it. We're in it for the long haul. But if we see the problem as being not forcing ourselves to eat foods we don't like, but actually changing our tastes, changing our habits and preferences, then it's possible.
Bea, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. That was Bea Wilson talking about her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. For more information about Bea Wilson and her books, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. In a moment, we'll be talking with Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising about growing a successful year-round garden. First, here's the Zucchini Song by Dan Crow.
We have a garden, I beg your pardon. We have a garden and we grow our own food. We have a garden, I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to shout and be so rude. We have some carrots and zucchini, some lettuce and zucchini, tomatoes and zucchini, and some peas. We have some cabbage and zucchini, some onions and zucchini, some pepper and zucchini, and some beef. We have some parsley and zucchini, some broccoli zucchini, mushrooms and zucchini, and some greens. Alfalfa in zucchini, cauliflower in zucchini, the celery in zucchini, and some beans. We have a garden! I beg your pardon. We have a garden and we grow our own food. We have a garden! I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to shout and be so rude. We have some berries and zucchini, melon and zucchini, pumpkin and zucchini, and some bugs. Spiders and zucchini, snails and zucchini, beetles and zucchini, and some slugs. Popcorn and zucchini, ice cream and zucchini, pizza and zucchini, and some kelp. Candy and zucchini, chocolate and zucchini, 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 help! We have a garden! I beg your pardon. We have a garden and we grow our own food. We have a garden! I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to shout and be so rude. No, I didn't mean to shout and be so rude. Oh, I didn't mean to shout and be so rude.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. That was The Zucchini Song by Dan Crow. It's a new year and people are making their resolutions. There are the traditional resolutions, such as getting in shape or spending less time looking at the computer screen. But maybe a resolution that you could consider is to grow more of your own food. We have permaculturist and educator Marisha Auerbach in the studio to talk with us about growing a year-round garden. Marisha, welcome to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
So I want to start. Each gardener has their own reason, but why do you want to grow your own food?
Well, I feel there's so many reasons for why I want to grow my own food. Primarily, I see the garden as a model of sustainability, and it becomes my meditation month after month, day after day, working in my garden. I really enjoy the atmosphere of just like spending time around all the birds and wildlife that come through the garden. I enjoy building the soil, and I really enjoy it right now while we're having so much rain that my yard isn't flooded with puddles or mud because we've been building soil. I love spending time in my garden and having friends over out there. But the reason I enjoy growing my own food is because I feel really connected with the seasons and it's more nutritious. I just love making meals out of things that I grew. It feels really good.
I know for me, what brought me into gardening is that first time when you taste that first fresh vegetable or fruit, and you just can't go back to you know, the foods that you get at the store that have been shipped miles and miles to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I go to Belize every year to teach a class. It's going to be actually next month in February, and I just can't eat bananas over here anymore. They're just tasteless. And I find that when I go and visit my family in Cleveland, that the food there just is really unsatisfying.
So about how much of your food do you get from your home garden?
Well, I actually would say that I get about 90% out of my garden. When I go to the store, I basically buy dairy, maybe some spices infrequently when I run out, sometimes grains. We eat a diet that's really high in vegetables. So sometimes we grow quinoa and corn. Those are the two grains I grew last year. I also grew garbanzo beans. And I try to plan for what I need. I do lots of canning and fermentation to put up the summer bounty for the winter. We also raise rabbits and chickens, so that's our primary meat source. We volunteer with the Portland Fruit Tree Project. Right now I'm buying eggs because my chickens aren't working as hard as they should be, so we're about to get some new birds. And then also when I go to Belize in February, I tend to bring back some of the tropical treats that I love, like cacao and coffee and turmeric and ginger and cinnamon, and I feel really fortunate to be able to have that connection in the tropics with my favorite foods down there.
So I'm sure you weren't growing 90% when you were starting, and we'll get to that, that process of learning from year to year. But I want to dive right into the home garden. So how much space does it take to grow all of your own vegetables?
Well, I'm going to go back a little bit to what you just said, and it did take a while. It took me 10 years to be able to decide that I was just going to stop going to the store and opening up the refrigerator looking for food. And instead, I was going to pattern myself to look outside because I knew that I had more than I needed. I find that a lot of gardeners tend to go to the refrigerator to look for food instead of going outside. And we tend to save our food that we're growing in the garden for later, because later's always better, but later never comes because it's always better. So that was a primary patterning change that I did to be able to recognize how much space it takes to grow my vegetables. And when I first started growing all my own produce throughout the year, I was living on 150 acres. And about 6 years ago, I moved to Portland to try to do that on a city lot, because most people in this country live on an average city lot, and I wanted to trick it out permaculture style. So I grow all my own produce on my city lot. It's a little larger than an average city lot. It's about 6,000 square feet. And through thoughtful design, we're able to do this. So that highlights our microclimates. We actually put on a 1,000 square foot green roof on our roof this year so that we could get more microclimates. Something like sweet potatoes is really hard to grow here in Portland. But by putting them up on the roof, I've been able to grow sweet potatoes too and really press that microclimate, get some really great melons, have a better pepper harvest. So I think that it can be done on a 5,000 square foot piece of property for a family of four.
So what you're describing, it sounds like you take advantage of some of that vertical space of the property. What can you do to maximize the space that you're growing in?
Well, vertical space is really important for the urban gardener, and there's so many wonderful things that grow in vertical spaces. When we get these really hot summers like we got last year, which is what I expect that we're going to see for the future, it's also important to shade some of our crops. Like lettuce into the summer really needs some shade, and that's a relief for people who say, my yard's too shady to grow food. You know, it's easier to grow salad greens, braising greens, broccoli and cabbage, all of those things do better in the shade. And often people who are trying to grow those brassicas in the sun will find that mid-season in the heat of the summer, they get a lot of aphids, and that's just a response to them being too hot. We also integrate our animals through the garden, which helps with pest cleanup and also turning over the beds. We do cover cropping and we often choose cover crops that we like to eat so that we can get more out of that space.
Do you choose varieties that that you can get sort of more of a concentrated harvest?
I do, yeah. And I also have been raising my own varieties year after year, where I've been selecting for the ones that do the best in the most challenging conditions so that they're more reliable into the future. And I think that's really important to look at as we look into the future and the reports of climate change. I think that growing your own food is one of those things that you can do in your life that is a response to some of those challenges by being able to steward the land where we live.
I know one example that I wouldn't have expected, but was recommended to me, was growing more potatoes. If you want to get more out of the space, one, you would, because they're so cheap at the store, you would think, well, I'll just save that space. But they produce a lot. They give you a second, that space once you've harvested, to use later in the season. And you can plant potatoes that you just, varieties that you can't find at the store that are very delicious.
It's true. And those fingerling potatoes can be a bit more expensive. I actually like how I can keep my potatoes in the ground all winter, because in the winter, the inside of our home gets really packed with the bounty of the harvest, with all the canned goods, the ferments, the squashes. We grew 300 pounds of squash on our city lot one year. And so having things that you can store in the ground in the winter, like potatoes or parsnips or even beets and carrots, helps increase the yield.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, the sort of peripheral to the gardening. I mean, you have your garden, but then there's also the tools and the storage. What does it take, you know, with the infrastructure to make a garden work?
That's a complex question, because there's so many different parts of a garden that someone could delve into. You know, in the first year, you know, you might just be looking for having the best tools. And of my two favorite tools, if I had to, you know, narrow down the two most essential tools, I'd say my hori hori, which is a Japanese farmer's knife that can be used for digging or dividing plants. It's got a serrated edge on it, and a pair of Felco pruners. If you're down in the tropics, they just say it's a machete. That's all they really use down there. Into the kitchen for canning and food preservation, there's so much that we can get at the Southeast Portland Kitchen Tool Library, and I think there's one in Northeast Portland too. So anyone listening to the show shouldn't feel like they need to get all these things. Some of the things that are essential is, of course, a canner. I don't have a pressure canner, so that's, you know, one tool that could be, that some people like to have, that I haven't been using. I double up my crock pot as my crock for fermentation. And I like to do small batch ferments in quart mason jars. And I have a couple of airlocks and stuff that go on top of those. I also have some buckets and glass jars that I use for making wine and cider, since we make that for the winter. My freezer is an essential tool. And I love my Excalibur dehydrator. That is my favorite one on the market. And that's been doing it strong for me for about 10 years now, probably. I also have a Champion juicer, which I like for homogenizing things. Just makes it a lot faster. But it's possible to do that sort of thing without needing energy by using, like, Squeezo, which is a food mill. And they have that at the Portland Tool Library, Kitchen Tool Library.
So growing your food and putting it up and all those processes, they take time. And so I'm wondering, how much time and energy does it take to have a successful home garden?
You know, I'd say that my partner and I spend about 20 hours a month on the garden. Most people are pretty surprised to hear that. I think it takes a lot less time than mowing a lawn. It's a lot more enjoyable than mowing a lawn and lets out a lot less pollution. And part of it is about having the right timing. And one of my favorite authors in the permaculture world, Masanobu Fukuoka, has a quote which says, do nothing, observe everything. Timing is important. And I think that that's one way that I've been able to really minimize the amount of time I spend is to know when that crucial moment is to intervene in what's going on and be able to increase the yield through my actions.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of what keeps people from starting that garden that first year is thinking about how they don't have the time to do it. And really, if you do it smart and you plan, it really doesn't take up much time and you can have food.
Yeah, and sometimes we get just so caught up in our job or whatever's going on in our life that we forget that it just takes a few minutes to do, you know, to put some seeds in water to soak them before planting, and then a couple, you know, and then it doesn't take that long later to just put them in, you know, if you've been building your soil and tending to your beds throughout the year. And that's actually why I developed my yearly gardening series that I do at People's Food Co-op. It's once a month, and people can take the whole series or just individual classes. And each month I give out a to-do list that lists all the things that we could do in the garden to be able to maximize our efforts.
I once heard it described as farming, and I think you can apply it to gardening, is all it is just moving things from one place to another. So the idea is that you want to do it as minimally as possible, but really as you move a seed into a seed tray and it grows, and then you move that plant into the ground. And when you think about it that way, yeah, then it's just these like little steps that you just move something and then wait for a while for it to happen.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that, you know, for our ancestors, they had this rhythm of the cycles of the year within their body, and they knew what they had to do at different times to be able to achieve the desired goal. And we don't have that as much anymore, but I don't think it's hard for us to return to have that rhythm again when we practice and try year after year. I'd like to say that humans and grocery stores really only evolved on this planet for a relatively short period of time together. And so when people say they have a black thumb, I don't think it's inherent that that person is a bad gardener. I think that right now we have a lot of challenges that inhibit our ability to have a good yield. I've been noticing some seed companies have a a decreased rate of germination when I start seeds from some of the larger seed companies. So it's important to support our local small seed companies in the Willamette Valley. We have such a wealth of really great genetics that have a great germination rate and are adapted to our climate.
So you are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. My guest right now is Marisha Auerbach, a permaculturist and educator. So how can we integrate perennials such as herbs and berries into the garden?
This is a great question. When I teach permaculture design, and I teach that through Oregon State University and Pacific University, and we do a summer class at Portland Community College. I also do it independently. And in permaculture design, we look at a site and we analyze the different factors on that site, different off-site elements and on-site elements. And berries and herbs have different needs, and that's important to consider. So I design my garden according to the management and fertility needs of the plants, and the things that have similar needs I group together. So for example, in my garden, I have a perennial herb garden that's very close to the kitchen for ease of harvest, and especially on these really rainy days like yesterday, it's really nice to be able to go out and get fresh herbs without getting soaked. It gives me more incentive to go out there and get that. But then I have a 10-foot perimeter around our backyard that I use for berries and fruit trees and medicinal herbs. And the chickens get rotated through here at just the right time because the chickens, in their manure, there's phosphorus, which is the crucial nutrient for fruiting and flowering. The chickens like to eat insects, so they help with pest control, and they also help with fruit cleanup so that we don't have rotting fruit contributing to disease in the landscape. And since medicinal herbs and perennial vegetables are harvested at specific times of the year, they can be placed in with that. We consider it our zone 2, our 10-foot perimeter around our yard. And then I go out there and I harvest them at just the right season to make medicine or for meals. And then we also have, we consider our front yard as our urban woodland, and that's where we also have more perennial perennial berry bushes and fruit trees and plants for habitat. So it's beautiful. It more meets a common aesthetic in our culture, and it's all managed in a similar way.
So what do you find is the most difficult thing about growing your own food?
Well, I think for us here in Portland, it's that long drought. It's that we have our longest drought period is 120 days over the 3 months of the summer. Any gardener last summer who remembers how hot it was and how much stress that caused on our plants. So it's important to be choosing varieties that are specifically adapted to our climate that can make the best use of the resources. And also it's important to respond to the long drought by maximizing our water storage in our soil so that we can offset how much watering we need to do, especially as the costs of our water in the city rise. That's a really important response so that the cost of gardening isn't really affecting the pocketbook too much. And we can do that by building compost and enriching the organic matter in our soil, which coincidentally also is what is needed to be able to help that water when we get the extended rains soak into our soil instead of running off into the storm drains.
So what can people do right now to start planning a year-round garden?
Well, I think right now it's a really great time to start mapping out your space, and that's what we're going to do in my first class of my workshop series in February is talk about how to do that, to identify where those microclimates are. As the sun shifts from the expansive sun that we get on summer solstice to the smaller angle of the sun that happens on winter solstice, between those extremes, it creates microclimates that are ideal for different plants. So as it's getting up to time to plant our peas, it's important to think about where is the warmest spot in the yard right now to nourish those peas for the earliest crop. I think people can start making a list of what they eat and to prioritize things that you eat often, things that have a small shelf life, and things that are expensive. And those are the low-hanging fruit for an urban gardener. You can also start eating seasonally. And as winter is the hardest time to get through with a garden, you can see what's available seasonally at the local farmers market so that you can strive to have that available at this time. And also starting a worm bin or a compost pile is a great way to start gearing up for soil fertility into the spring when it's time to plant.
So we're about out of time, but I want to, you've talked about these classes that you're going to be teaching at Peoples. Could you tell us what are some other classes that you're going to be teaching throughout the season?
Well, the workshop series at Peoples starts in February, and I just mentioned it starts with the first classes on planning, design, and framework. In March, we're going to start focusing on seed starting, early season plantings. In April, we go into the brassicas. May, we're going to talk about edible flowers and attracting pollinators. In June, we go into maintenance and harvest as the bounty starts coming in. I also have permaculture design courses coming up. We do an online course through Oregon State University, which will be starting next in March. And I do a summer class at Portland Community College in person. I've got this permaculture design course in Belize that's coming up in February for anyone who wants to beat the rain and go down into the jungle in the land of the Maya and learn about cacao and coffee. And then I'll be doing another two-week permaculture design course intensive in Williams, Oregon at the White Oak Farm from March 18th to April 1st.
So where can people find information about these classes and workshops?
All these workshops are listed on my website, which is permaculturerising.com.
Great. Marisha, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Show.
Thanks for having me here, Chris. I appreciate it.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach talking about growing your own food and having a year-round garden. And that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kbu.fm. I want to thank our guests, Bea Wilson and Marisha Auerbach, for being on today's show. I also want to thank our wonderful board operator, Kate. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of February for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat.
right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying their throat, need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying their throat, need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be, 'cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat, they need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same.
And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting Nashville-based band The Wood Brothers with Chris Wood of Medeski, Martin, and Wood, Saturday, January 30th at the Roseland Theater in downtown Portland. The Wood Brothers perform with Liz Weiss, and tickets and information are available at cascadetickets.com.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.